to be human is to be scientific. It's to looking into why things are and questioning things. And then when you find something out, you share it with other people. And that's what science is.
Well, I think it's all about curiosity. People are fascinated by the world, you know, and everybody's a scientist. Never forget that.
I think curiosity drove my passion. Science surrounds us. We live through science. And that curiosity was actually my drive.
Scientists Shane Bergen, Luke O'Neill and Valeria Nicolosi there. And the product of science, technology, is all around us. It shapes our lives. From smartphones with apps that help us find our way,
you have arrived,
to supermarket tills that talk and scold us.
Please take your change.
But more significantly, technological innovation is helping us live longer and confronting some of the most challenging disabilities we face. I'm Dr. Laura Dungan, and in this episode of Science is Everywhere, I'm exploring the science of technology and innovation and asking how it can help a blind man to see and a deaf child to hear, or how a material that's in lead pencils can hold the key to faster and safer transport. But I'm curious as to what makes a scientist. And to find out, I'm back in Trinity College Dublin with someone who can help, Danny Kelly, the director of the Centre for Bioengineering here. Danny, this is a very impressive lab, lots of activity. But I mean, how did it all start for you?
I would have started out as a kid, like most kids, playing with Lego, building things and getting interested in putting things together. And I guess I was always curious about how things worked and how we could make things. And that led me into engineering.
Danny, I love that it all started with Lego, but you're now engineering not with bricks and buildings, but with tissues and cells. I mean, with human body parts.
It was towards the end of my undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering when I was made aware of this whole field of biomedical engineering, which is all about how we can use engineering principles to solve clinical or medical problems. And it was from there that I got into this area of tissue engineering. And in many ways, you can think of tissue engineering in a bit way like the Lego. We're using the cells as building blocks to build new tissues or to regenerate new tissues.
So how do you literally grow new bones or human tissue?
So the basic approach really is to take cells, ideally cells from the patient who has damaged tissue, and to put those cells onto a porous material. We call that material a scaffold. And this provides structural support to the cells. And then we stimulate the cells, and we can stimulate the cells with chemical cues, like drugs, or we can stimulate the cells with mechanical cues, similar to the kind of mechanical loading that the cells might experience in the body, with the hope that those stimuli will encourage the cells to make a new tissue. So in the case, say, of bone, to make new bone tissue, or in the case of cartilage, to make new cartilage tissue. So a big part of this then is understanding how to make a cell produce the right type of tissue.
So this is what we know as stem cell research.
So a stem cell is a cell that can theoretically differentiate into many different types of specialised cells. So from a small number of stem cells, we could take, say, from my bone marrow or your bone marrow, we can obtain millions and millions of cells. So, you know, the traditional tissue engineering idea was that we'd take the cells, we'd expand them outside the body, and we'd try and grow a tissue outside the body. And in many cases, we're going to have to do that. But increasingly, we're looking at ways of, say, implanting a material or a scaffold or some type of system into the body that can recruit the stem cells that are in our body and try and enhance their capacity to promote regeneration.
Now, I know one of the areas you're working on is the very common and very painful problem of knee injury. It's currently a really expensive process to repair the joint. I mean, it costs about €35,000 for the procedure. How is your work going to be changing that?
So one of the things we're looking at in my lab is ways to overcome the need for expanding cells outside the body and having two surgical procedures. So we've been looking at a fatty tissue behind your kneecap. It's called the infrapatellar fat pad. And we've shown that you can make very nice cartilage using stem cells that are in this fatty tissue behind your kneecap. So we're now working on ways of trying to very quickly pull out stem cells from this fatty tissue inside the operating theatre and then putting it straight back into the defect. So instead of having to expand the cells outside the body and take the patient back a second time into the operating theatre, we can do it all in one go.
So what I'm looking at here is you and your colleagues growing replacement bones. You must enjoy telling people that when they ask, what do you do?
Yeah. Well, I guess it's, you know, science and engineering, you're letting your imagination go wild in a sense. You're solving problems that are really interesting to you. So I love my job because every day I go in and we have new and exciting problems to address. And that's a great position to be in.
Danny Kelly there in his journey from Lego bricks to stem cells. But what do you think? Do you see the benefits of science and technology in your health and lives?
Yes, definitely. In every single way. We couldn't say that hasn't improved our life. Without it, we'd probably be dead by 30.
Yeah, I think science has improved people's quality of life because of improvements from basic research and medical treatment. People are living longer, they're healthier lives.
There are better drugs now, better treatments.
But what about disability? Do you think technology can solve those challenges?
Yeah, well, I know a guy with a cochlear implant, so that would be a good improvement.
Well, it's still at experimental stages, I know that, but it has helped a lot of people.
I think science still has a lot to give disabled people, but I think compared to probably about 100 years ago, we've made huge leaps and bounds.
I'm over at the gym at Trinity College Dublin now to meet an amazing guy who's working on the weights machine, but who knows more than most about this, as he's blind and now paralysed.
I'm Mark Pollock, and I'm a sportsman, an adventurer, and I'm starting to become a bionic man.
Mark, you're doing your weights here with your friend and trainer Simon, and I know you both raced to the South Pole in 2008. I mean, you made history then as a blind man.
I was not long back from the South Pole. I was an adventure athlete. I had my own business giving motivational talks. And just at the start of July 2010, I had an accident, fell out of a second-story window and broke my back, fractured my skull, massive internal injuries, broke bones, bleeds in my brain, just endless injuries, which put me into a whole world of intensive care and then on into a world of living in a wheelchair and trying to rehabilitate myself from that.
So at one level, Mark, the fact that you even survived that fall is incredible.
The medical world, the science world, the technology world is taking people like me who a short few years ago would have died, would have had terrible brain injuries, a wildly unpredictable problem, and the medical science technology world has somehow managed to turn that whole problem into a routine system, save people's lives and get them out the hospital door living meaningful lives. I have benefited greatly from that world because I'm not dead, because I'm out of hospital, because I'm healthy. But on the other side, in order to take those wild jumps forward, in order to deal with something which is at the moment completely unsolvable, that's paralysis. There is no cure, there is no intervention to fix this. Where I am now starting to operate is a world where physiologists meet technologists, meet biologists who are all trying to solve the problem of spinal cord injury or the problem of paralysis.
I mean, from the beginning, despite your broken spine, you said you were determined to walk again. And I mean, it's just remarkable. That's exactly what you're doing here.
I felt if I stayed fit and strong, I would put myself in the best possible position to take advantage of any big innovations that came down the line. And the first of those innovations, which came much quicker than I thought, was an exoskeleton, a set of robotic legs. And I tested a couple of different devices, but eventually, having walked in an exobionics robotic suit in California and then in Cambridge and then eventually buying my own device and bringing it to Dublin, I now walk on a daily basis in an intelligent robotic suit. And I'm progressing now up to about a third of normal walking speed in the gym.
Amazing. Mark, I know you're also following the work of people like Danny Kelly and the stem cell regeneration, but what has this bionic or robotic suit really meant to you?
To stand and walk as someone who spends most of their time either lying down or sitting in a wheelchair, to have the option and access to a machine that allows me to stand and walk is hugely impactful from a psychological and a physical point of view. I'm not sure what it's doing physically inside the body to my nervous system, but I've got a hunch that if I sit in a wheelchair for the rest of my life, I'll get good at sitting down. If I stand and walk, it must be doing something interesting to the inside of my body. And the next moves for me are now to try and get scientists to start looking at what's happening when I walk, what's happening inside the body. Every time I go into the gym, feeling under pressure, sore back, spasming legs, I get up, I walk, and I come out of it feeling 10 times better. It just feels right to stand and walk. It does not feel right to sit down. But I suppose where I'm sitting now as a much more as an explorer now than I ever was going to the South Pole, the world I'm sitting in now has no answers, has no data, and now that's what we're trying to do, to get some data around what I feel is right.
One of the things Mark Pollock is exploring is the idea that the brain is plastic. So I'm back in NUI Maynooth, talking to Professor Richard Roach, chairman of the Brain Council. Richard, I keep hearing this, but what does it mean? How is the brain plastic?
Well, the idea of brain plasticity is basically the concept that the structure of the brain is changeable and flexible and can change quite easily. People do have brains that are able to try and fix themselves. Our brain tries to rewire itself to compensate for these areas that have been damaged, and it can form new circuits that can act in a compensatory way to replace some of these functions that have been impaired following damage. We are really at the very start of really properly understanding it. And I think in the last 50 or 60 years, we've probably discovered more about it than we had done in the previous 2000 or so.
Psychologist Fiona Newell at Trinity College Dublin is equally driven by this idea that we can re-engineer our brains.
We're really at the beginning of understanding how the brain formulates those types of problems and how it comes up with solutions to those types of problems. We're nowhere near coming up with a computer, for example, that can do anything like the fundamental process that the human brain can do. And so I'm fascinated by that. I think it has a huge amount of implications. If we understand how the sensory systems work in the brain, then we can do a lot of things with that. So, for example, way back in the 1980s, an engineer called Paul Bacciurita, he's quoted as saying, "We don't see with our eyes, we see with our brain." He's absolutely right in that. And that simply means that if we can stimulate the visual region of the brain in a way in which it's stimulated by the eye in a normally sighted person, then we can recover visual function.
Fiona mentioned scientist Paul Bacciurita, who pioneered the field of neuroplasticity and developed a device which allows blind people to see using their taste buds. Bacciurita has sadly since died of cancer. But I talked to his colleague Bob Beckman in the US and asked him how it all works.
The way the device works is that we process information from a video camera, in other words, the scene around the blind person. We process information from a video camera and display it on the person's tongue via electrotactile stimulation. It feels like streaming bubbles on the person's tongue, and it allows a person who is totally blind to gain perception of their surroundings. Paul recognized that people who are totally blind would be able to process information in the visual cortex section of their brain and appropriately learn to interpret the streaming electrotactile stimulation on their tongue, learn to interpret that information as the scene around them.
And Bob, if we can see using our taste buds, are there other examples, other ways of rewiring our brains?
I would say that cochlear implants are very similar. Cochlear implants stimulate the auditory nerve directly, but they are a form of an alternate sensor that provides, in this case, hearing information to a person who is deaf.
Who's this?
A yellow car.
A yellow car. And who's this?
A sofa.
My name's Danielle Ryan and my daughter is Ellie and she's 3 years old and she's profoundly deaf in both ears and has one cochlear implant nearly a year now.
I got one on the car.
You went in the car, yeah.
Well, Ellie had progressive hearing loss, so she was born with her hearing and developed a very small amount of speech. And then what happened was we noticed that the speech started to disappear, basically. No new words developed, and the words that she did have were no longer there.
And when you were told your baby was deaf, did you know anything about cochlear implants?
Yeah, we really didn't know anything about cochlear implants until we were referred to the cochlear implant unit. We were basically just told, listen, this could be an option for your child and this could help her hear and speak.
And Danielle, as the mummy rather than the scientist, how does Ellie's cochlear implant let her hear?
Okay, so a cochlear implant is a device that allows a profoundly deaf person hear and gives them the ability to speak. The device is made up of the internal and the external part. The internal part has an array of 22 electrodes that's inserted into the cochlea, and that's the piece of the equipment that has to be able to do 2.5 turns around the cochlea. Each of those electrodes represent different sounds, and they are the electrodes that will go through the different hearing tests. From that, the external part is connected through the magna, and that's how the internal and the external part are connected. So as soon as Ellie puts her implant on in the morning, she has the speech processor that's around her ear that has speakers that takes the sound in, and then there's a coil and a magnet, and as soon as she, like if that falls off, she just flicks it back on and the magnet sticks together. So the sound is taken in through the speech processor and then it's sent to the electrodes, as far as I know, and anyway, that's what happens, and then the signal is sent straight to the brain and the brain interprets that sound.
Your lights. Where's your lights?
Her lights, that's what she calls them. There's a little flashing light on it for children and anyway, so we know, depending on the colour of the light, if it's working or not. And she calls that, her implant is her lights, like, you know what I mean? And as soon as she gets up in the morning, she wants them on. Recently, she's refusing to take them off, going to bed. She wants to hear everything. And like you and me, you wouldn't want to be switched off at night, so she doesn't either. So it's great. She's really taken to it very well.
You want two lights, I know you do.
Today, Danielle and Ellie are hoping to get a second implant so Ellie can hear through both ears.
Why got man said don't know?
The man said, I don't know. We have to wait and see. Will the man let you have two lights? We'll find out soon.
In just 10 years, the lives of deaf children in Ireland have been transformed by the availability of cochlear implants, or bionic ears, as some call them. And part of the scientific transformation underpinning all of these new technologies which surround us is nanotechnology. So I asked leading researchers Professor Valeria Nicolosi and our old friend physicist Dr. Shane Bergen at the Amber Centre at Trinity College just what is nanotechnology and why is everyone talking about it?
Nanotechnology now surrounds us. It's nothing, it's not a fiction. It's not fiction anymore. You have use nanotechnology every day. You use a mobile phone, you have nanotechnology inside. You use a computer, you have nanotechnology inside it. You use a shirt, you will have nanotechnology in there. Everything from medical devices to cars to the batteries you use, 90% of the common things you use in a day actually have nanoscience in it.
Until very recently, every material that we used was a three-dimensional material. So that means it has like a height, a width and a breadth, three dimensions. But scientists, not that long ago, postulated what would happen if you were to completely reduce one or more of the dimensions of the material so that it's only maybe an atom or so big. So effectively, you could have a two-dimensional material, one with no height, or you could have a one-dimensional material, so it only had effectively one axis. And what that does is it opens up an entire new field of science. So it combines the excitement of atomic and quantum physics in the early 20th century, all that stuff that was put out there was completely wacky at the time. But now we're able to touch it. We're able to tangibly use it. So materials behave very differently when you reduce one or more of their dimensions. And nanoscience is the investigation of how they behave differently, and the exploitation then is nanotechnology.
Valeria, I'm rubbing a lead pencil here against this piece of paper, and apparently that's creating a material which holds the key to our future.
It's graphite, the lead that you have in every pencil. This is made of stacks and stacks and stacks of billions of layers of carbon. So what happens is, if you rub a pencil on a piece of paper, you will end up scrubbing these layers apart.
Now, accidentally, what you actually end up with on your piece of paper is a completely new material that is not called graphite anymore, but it's called graphene. And this graphene actually is one of the most wonderful materials that could exist and was discovered only a few years ago. It's the most flexible material, the most transparent material. It's the strongest material. It's 300 times stronger than steel. I mean, we have within Amber, we use these materials for a huge number of applications that span from the semiconducting industry to the beer companies. So when you think about Google exploring these new concepts of new glasses, watches, wearable clothing, they contain the same nanomaterial, but developed into a different device. If you think about smartphones, the screens will not be the same, will be still using perhaps graphene as material or nanomaterials in general, but rather than being very fragile, you know, you drop your phone and that's it, your screen is gone. It will not be like that because it will be completely flexible. We will arrive to the stage where your phone can be folded up and put it in your pocket exactly as you put with a piece of paper, because that's what you're going to go for. Ultra thin, flexible. And this is already implemented. I mean, if you look at the aircrafts, for example, or parts of your car, they already use some nanotechnology.
Shane, I guess like most people, I thought nanotechnology was all about things getting smaller. But for nanoscientists like yourself, that's kind of really missing the point, isn't it?
Stop thinking about it that way, right? Think about it's just materials on a whole new level. It's like once you get down to the nano level, they're just entirely different. It's like, so graphite on the macro level, the big level, behaves fundamentally differently to when you have one sheet of graphene on the nano level. It's like chalk and cheese. So it's all about touching those things, using those things, understanding them, exploiting them.
Oh, brave new world that has such materials in it. So whether it's regenerating parts of the body, rewiring the brain, or creating computers that you can fold away and put in your pocket, our future is being shaped by new technologies and the scientific minds inventing them. I'm Dr. Lara Dungan, and this is Science is Everywhere. Next, in our final episode, it's the story of the vanishing bees. And should we be worried if they are disappearing?